Today's speaker is Peter Van Loon. He comes from us from the MU for Research Group at the University of Erlangen, where he's going to tell us about hybrid quantum computing systems.
Okay, so first of all, thank you to Steve for inviting me here and giving me the opportunity to talk to you. I would like to point out that this Max Planck Research Group is going to become a Max Planck Institute for the Science of Light at the beginning of next year. Science at this institute is not only devoted to quantum optics and quantum optical implementations of quantum information, obviously, but in a more general context to, well, optics, including classical optics, of course. So let me start by giving you a dictionary entry on the word hybrid. So what do I mean by hybrid? Hybrid is something heterogeneous in original composition. In biology, it's crosses between species. And more generally, it is something that has two different types of components that essentially perform the same function. And for example, a hybrid quantum computer is a computer system that consists of both analog and discrete or digital components at the same time. And this is, in a way, what we have in mind with regard to quantum information applications here, using at the same time continuous and discrete quantum variables. So here's a summary slide on quantum information. Of course, you are all most familiar with these notions and concepts. So on the upper part, there are these fundamental results and these more conceptual notions. And going to the bottom of the slide, it gets more applied in a way. So there are these important routines in quantum communication and quantum information processing, teleportation and cryptography, which both, possibly on different levels, but both would rely upon the resource of entanglement. And the resource of entanglement at the same time is also a sufficient resource for doing a long distance quantum communication and universal quantum computation. And these are the two applications I would like to describe to you in a quantum optical context in some detail. Entanglement may become manifest in, well, two different ways. One is in a discrete way. Here it's written down in terms of qubits, or in a continuous verbal fashion. This would be the kind of famous EPR, Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen state. So you're all familiar with these notions. And then quantum communication would mean we send a potentially unknown non-orthogonal quantum state through a channel between Alice and Bob. There might be an eavesdropper or just an environment describing a noisy channel. And if we go to larger distances, for instance, really large distance, as long as 1,000 kilometers or so, the problem would be that if we think of an optical implementation using single photons, the photons would hardly survive this, the travel through the fiber. They would hardly reach the end of the fiber. So the probability for a photon to reach the other end would decrease exponentially. So what can we do? Classically, in classical optical communication, one would just divide the channel into various segments, and one would re-amplify a classical pulse, a classical signal. This is impossible quantum mechanically because we cannot really make many copies of a noisy unknown quantum state in order to purify it to a purer version. But what we can do, we can of course distribute a standard resource over sufficiently short segments of the channels, and the standard resource is entanglement. So we would distribute entangled states, and then we would purify these states and eventually use entanglement swapping to extend the entanglement of the entire distance. So this is the well-known quantum repeater protocol. And then in the context of quantum computing, there are at least two models for describing universal quantum computation. One is the most traditional model. That's the circuit model, where a state evolves from left to right in terms of a sequence of reversible unitary gates. Conversely, this one-way quantum computation model no longer consists of a reverse sequence of gates, but it is rather irreversible because all the gates can be realized by just doing measurements on this pre-prepared multi-party entangled cluster state. Okay, now let me talk a little bit about quantum optics. Why would we be using optical or quantum optical realizations for these quantum information tasks and protocols? So obviously light is is probably the most convenient medium for communication, similar to the classical case. And it turned out that light is also very useful for efficient, well, at least small scale implementations of quantum gates and quantum logic. So in the standard approaches to quantum optics and in quantum optics textbooks, the electromagnetic field is described in terms of these annihilation operators having a discrete label here, and these discrete labels or mode variables would contain all possible degrees of freedom, including polarization and the frequencies, and they are all contained in this subscript K, and eventually we would just look at these discrete individual single modes described by an annihilation operator, AK, obeying the usual bosonic commutators here, and looking at the Hamiltonian of the entire field, one finds out that it corresponds to a sum of individual quantized harmonic oscillators, where the photon number in mode K would just be described by this number operator here, and that's just the excitation number of the quantized harmonic oscillator. Okay, and then we've got the usual representations. We've got the Fock representation. We have these energy eigenstates with lowering and raising operators, or in the optical context corresponding to photon annihilation and creation operators, the vacuum state, and here the completeness and the orthogonality of these Fock basis states. And so this representation is very useful to describe states of just a few photons, single photon states, theoretically. Experimentally, these states are actually pretty hard to create, and they are also pretty hard to detect, in particular if the photon number gets larger, because we want to resolve larger photon numbers. This is a very, very demanding task for the experimentalist. Then we could also actually look at these momentum and position operators in these oscillator Hamiltonians. These correspond to the real and imaginary parts of the annihilation and creation operators up to some dimensional factors. So we might rescale these, and then we get these dimensionless position and momentum operators defining the condition, the continuous position and momentum basis states. For these observables, the momentum, that the vacuum state has a second moment in position and momentum, which is, well, depending on the scales, just 1/4 here. Then we've got the usual completeness and orthogonality relations. And this representation in terms of position and momentum basis states is very useful for describing, for instance, Gaussian states, which would have a continuous variable Gaussian probability distribution in the wave function. And Gaussian states are experimentally easy to create in a way, so they're effectively the states coming out of a laser. And even for larger photon numbers, they would be reasonably easy to detect in these bases, XMP, because that would correspond to homodyne detection. In fact, in homodyne detection, we can measure a whole continuum of these quadratures. So look at this rotated coordinate system, depending on this angle theta. So this defines a pair of conjugate quadratures for each theta value. And the nice thing is that in homodyne detection, in quantum optics, we have indeed access to this whole continuum of quadratures by just adjusting the local oscillator used for doing the homodyne detection. Okay, and then here are a few additional representations and states in quantum optics, the coherent state, the squeeze states here, where the uncertainties are reduced or increased along the x and the p axis. Then the most convenient representation to describe Gaussian states would be the Wigner function, where a Gaussian state is completely defined through this second moment correlation matrix that contains all the second moments in terms of X and P operators. Of course, we also need the first moments, which are set to zero in this example. But the first and the second moments together give complete information about a Gaussian state. So here's an example, a coherent state with mean values X naught and P naught drawn there in phase space. And this is the Wigner function of such a state. OK, now if we'd like to encode quantum information into these optical states using these optical representations, then there is the there are basically two ways to do that in terms of discrete variables. One way is the so-called occupation number representation. And the other way is the dual rail qubit representation. If we go to qdits, then it would be a multiple rail. But here, look at this example of the dual rail qubit. It means the qubit or the two orthogonal qubit basis states are encoded into two modes and one photon here. Here's an example for such a dual rail encoding. So it would mean that the photon occupies the horizontally polarized mode, but the vertically polarized mode is in a vacuum state. And here it's just the converse situation. The horizontally polarized mode is in a vacuum state, but the vertically polarized mode is excited by a photon. And this is, in a way, the most practical or most convenient representation and encoding for the experimentalist to do quantum information processing. And it is, of course, not necessarily the best way, because, for instance, for certain quantum gates, it turns out that, for instance, the occupation number representation is very good for achieving entangling gates. Yeah, for entangling qubits, in this representation, we could just use a beam splitter. This is not the case for this dual rail qubit encoding, because in this case, it would mean we have to make two photons interact. And this two photon interaction cannot be achieved by just using linear elements, by just using beam splitters. Conversely, a single qubit gate is very easy to do in this dual rail encoding. Just look at these polarization encoded qubits. It would just correspond to a polarization rotation. Whereas such a single qubit gate is actually hard to achieve for this occupation number qubit. OK, so we've got different difficulties in these different encodings. Nonetheless, the most commonly used one is this polarization encoding. And here I have an example of an experiment in which this polarization encoding was used. This is the, well, one of the, well, I guess, two first quantum teleportation experiments for discrete variables using single photon states and, well, potentially unknown polarization state, qubit state, was teleported. And I just explained to you that it is hard to achieve these entangling gates with single photon states in this polarization dual rail encoding. And similarly, it is difficult to achieve a complete Bell measurement. And what they did is in this experiment, they just used the beam splitter. And then they did the photon counting at the output modes of the beam splitter. And then they just achieved a success rate of 50%. So only in half of the cases, they can unambiguously identify the Bell states and project onto the Bell basis. And in fact, this is the optimum you can achieve by just using beam splitters. Then here, the continuous variable representations. Again, we've got the coherent state and the squeeze state. And in this case, well, the first quantum teleportation experiment was done in 1998 in the group by Jeff Kimball. And in this case, we can indeed replace the C0 gate for a Bell measurement by a beam splitter, do homodyne detections at the output modes here of this beam splitter, send the classical information to Bob. The resource in this case would be an entangled two-mode squeezed Gaussian state. And in this way, you can teleport an unknown state, in this case a coherent state, to the other side, up to some, well, imperfections which come from the finite squeezing, which is in these entangled resource states. Nonetheless, the Bell measurement, in a way, can be done to arbitrary accuracy, depending on the efficiency of these homodyne detectors, just using beam splitters and homodyne detection. OK, these were two examples for both the continuous variable and the discrete variable regimes. using multi-photon states, squeeze states, or using just single photon states. And more generally, the processing of these states using the most practical elements we have available, namely linear optical elements, so beam splitters, phase shifters, this would always be described in this way. We would have a vector of these mode annihilation operators at the input, and we transform them into a vector of these mode operators at the output, and this would always be described by a linear input-output relation with a unitary matrix here. And a very important result here is that any such unitary matrix U can be realized by a sequence of these, well, two-port devices in combination with these phase shifters. So a sequence of, well, simple beam splitters and phase shifters enables me to implement an arbitrary unitary matrix. It's not an arbitrary unitary operator, it's an arbitrary unitary matrix acting on these mode operators. If it was an arbitrary unitary operator acting on the Hilbert spaces, then we would be done, because then we could do anything by linear optics, but that's obviously not the case. So this really only refers to this mixing of these mode operators. However, there are special cases where these two things are actually equivalent. This special case would be single photon states. So if I have really states with exactly just a single photon, but not more photons, this would enable me to actually achieve any unitary operator as well at the same time. But for instance, entangling two photons would mean I have already a two photon state. Or doing a Bell measurement means already I do a projection onto two photon states. So then this no longer works. OK, this is the linear transformation describing passive linear optics, which means the photon number would be completely preserved in these types of circuits. Now we may also add the creation operators here in this linear transformation. That would mean it no longer describes a photon number preserving transformation. It would describe a so-called linear unitary Bogle-Yubov transformation. It is this Lubov here. And it would include squeezing, and it would describe an arbitrary quadratic Hamiltonian. So this linear input-output relation describes an arbitrary quadratic Hamiltonian, and that would correspond to an arbitrary Gaussian transformation. You remember I had the slide with these Gaussian states, and a Gaussian transformation by definition maps a Gaussian state back onto a Gaussian state. So in other words, this transformation can be also completely described in terms of the second moment correlation matrix. If we use this representation, then these would be called so-called symplectic transformations. So this is all equivalent. Symplectic transformations, Gaussian transformations, linear unitary Bogle-Yubov transformations. It just depends on the representation I'm using. And combining these two types of linear optical transformations, namely the passive one and the active ones, in order to obtain an arbitrary quadratic interaction, an arbitrary Lubov transformation, this can be done in a very compact way using the singular value decomposition. We can decompose any such Lubov circuit into a three-step procedure where the first and the third step correspond to just passive linear optics networks, so including just beam splitters and phase shifters. And here the middle step would include single mode squeezing transformations. So we would achieve multimode, any multimode squeezing transformation by just using multimode linear optics and single mode squeezing transformations. Okay, now I talked a lot about linear optical transformations, including squeezing. If we go beyond the regime of quadratic interactions corresponding to these linear input-output relations, we would enter the regime of, well, for instance, cubic or even higher nonlinear interactions. Here, the example is a fourth order Hamiltonian that would correspond to the so-called cross-Kerr interaction. So we've got two optical modes, A and B, and you see the Hamiltonian is of fourth order here. And if we had access to a cross-Kerr interaction of this type with a coupling strength of pi, this is this is an effective interaction time here, which means, of course, we can evolve our system sufficiently long to achieve this pi. However, the problem is that then losses would dominate over this Kerr effect. So it is indeed very hard to achieve such a pi interaction strength. Nonetheless, if we had access to this gate, applying it to these photon number basis states would mean we could achieve a controlled sine gate. In other words, we could achieve a CNOT gate, adding local Hadamard gates here, so we could do a universal quantum computation. Note that this is occupation number encoding here, but if we used instead the dual rail encoding and we apply this interaction to rails 2 and 4, it would still mean that only the logical 1, 1 would acquire a sign, whereas the other basis states remain untouched. So if this was possible, we were done. The problem is, on the level of single photon states, we cannot achieve a sufficiently large nonlinear interaction of this type. Similarly, in the regime of continuous variables, this kind of interaction, fourth order, for instance, would clearly yield a non-Gaussian state or various types of non-Gaussian states, for instance, these cat states. These are obviously also hard to obtain. And in this case, it's not so obvious why it would be useful to produce these states for quantum information processing. It is only known, basically, that for certain tasks, these non-Gaussian elements are actually needed. So they must be part of the protocol at some point. OK, here's a summary slide on optical quantum information processing. We've got the unitary transformations on the left side here in this column, the interaction Hamiltonians, and the input-output relations. So this is just summarizing what I told you before. The Gaussian transformations are those corresponding to linear and quadratic interactions, describing at most linear transformations. Could be also scalar that would correspond to just the displacement in phase space. So, and they include squeezing transformations. These are still described by linear transformations in terms of the mode operators. But physically, squeezing would be achieved by nonlinear optical interactions. So you would need some kind of nonlinear, for instance, Chi2 susceptibility to achieve the squeezing. And then here's the non-Gaussian regime, which corresponds to cubic or higher order interactions. OK, now why would we be interested in using discrete and continuous variables at the same time? So the discrete variable encoding, for instance, this polarization encoding, does not enable us to fulfill every quantum information task. For instance, there is this no-go theorem for Bell measurements. We cannot do a complete Bell measurement. And obviously, we cannot do universal quantum computation. If we could, we could, of course, also do this. We could also do any measurement, of course. So similar here in the continuous variable regime, there are some no-go results for universal quantum computing based on only Gaussian resource states and Gaussian operations, but also actually for, well, other tasks in a different context, entanglement purification, for instance, or just quantum error correction. It is impossible to do that by just using Gaussian operations, having just Gaussian signal states. So, and here the idea is now to circumvent these restrictions by combining the two approaches using discrete and continuous variables. Of course, there are other possible ways to circumvent these restrictions, for instance, inducing nonlinearities by doing measurements or using weak nonlinearities. And in fact, you may also combine these different approaches, obviously. OK, so hybrid means, in this context, combining different encodings, operations, and protocols. And why would we do that? We want to minimize the resource costs for the implementations. So let me give you a few examples. So the, well, for quantum opticians, probably the most straightforward example would be to encode a qubit as a kind of superposition state between coherent states. in the infinite dimensional Hilbert space of a bosonic mode. So note that if alpha becomes really large, these two states become approximately orthogonal. So we would indeed have a qubit defined in this subspace of the optical mode. And why would that be beneficial? Well, it's similar to these different encodings for single photon-based qubits, occupation number, dual rail qubit encoding. Some gates are pretty straightforward to implement, and others are very hard to implement. So here, for instance, entangling gate, once again, are easy to implement, just beam splitters. Single qubit gates are hard to implement. For instance, look at the Hadamard gate. The Hadamard gate would mean turning the, say, zero basis state into a superposition of 0 and 1, which means we have to turn a coherent state into a superposition of two coherent states. So we have to turn a Gaussian state into a non-Gaussian state. So we would need clearly a non-Gaussian transformation. Here's another scheme where, again, a discrete variable state is encoded into an optical mode. I think this is most familiar here, the scheme. This can be used for quantum error correction of, in this case, not the typical types of errors in qubit quantum information processing, namely like stochastic bit flips or phase flips, but rather small shifts, which would mean that these code words must be in a way resistant against these small shifts, and we must still be able to discriminate between the different subspaces for no error or an error occurred, a small shift occurred. And for this, one may use in phase space, for instance, here a code word. These are the logical basis states. A code word, which is here a coherent superposition of these delta type peaks in phase space. Pretty hard to practically realize, but very efficient against these small errors. Then a converse situation would be to protect not a qubit, but indeed an infinite dimensional continuous variable state against a kind of stochastic discrete error. So look at this error model here, which is in a way, well, artificial. An input state described by this Wigner function would be turned through this channel into an output state, which is an incoherent mixture of these two possibilities. Either the state remains untouched, or there is an error. And this error might be a displacement, or it might be even a squeezing, or a cubic gate, anything. But the crucial feature of this channel is that it is discrete or stochastic. And in this way, it is possible to circumvent this no-go result, which was just very recently on the archive, where it was proven that Gaussian quantum error correction is not useful to protect Gaussian signal states against Gaussian errors. So everything is Gaussian in this scenario. And then these Gaussian protocols would not enable you to correct the Gaussian errors. And as you can see here in this example, the error would be non-Gaussian. So in this way, you can circumvent this no-go theorem. And if we look at an example, this is the well-known Shor code for qubits. And down here would be the continuous verbal version of this code. And there has been an experiment in the group of Akira Furusawa in Tokyo, where he combined, well, many, many squeeze states, in this case, 8 squeezers, using arrays of beam splitters in order to encode a Gaussian input state in this case. And then he would send all these encoded modes through a channel where a certain error occurs, well, in strictly one channel. That was the restriction in this experiment. However, if the error model would be of this nature that I showed to you on the previous slide, then this artificial constraint that we have an error strictly in one channel would no longer be necessary, because in this case, we would be in a regime which is reminiscent of what we typically have for qubits, where many codes also, the simplest codes also can only correct single qubit errors. But of course, in these stochastic models, multi-qubit errors would be highly unlikely. So here, this situation is very similar. And it was demonstrated in this experiment that indeed you can undo these displacement errors that occur in one of these 9 channels. That was also in the archive very recently, I think 2 days ago. Okay, another example for a hybrid approach here is a light matter interface for quantum communication. So in this case, hybrid would mean I would combine matter and optical systems. I think that was originally the scenario when the term hybrid was used first, basically combining optical approaches on light systems with matter systems. And this is an obvious approach for quantum communication because we need some quantum memory. For instance, think of this quantum repeater scheme. At all these repeater stations, we need some quantum memories. We need systems that store that can store the quantum information. So this very famous scheme here, that's the Duan Lukin Sirak-Solla quantum repeater proposal, that would indeed be based on an ensemble of atoms at these repeater stations, and they would become entangled using photons that are scattered from these atoms and that would travel through the channel, and then you would have some coincidence measurements, and then you would, it's a non-deterministic scheme, it's actually, the efficiencies are not so high. However, it's a very powerful scheme nonetheless, because note that these atoms here, this cloud of atoms is in free space, so you don't need cavity QED schemes, where you have a lot of inefficiencies by coupling in and out of the cavity. So this is in free space, and the light would just interact with all these atoms, but then eventually this whole protocol is indeed a fully discrete verbal protocol. So the degrees of freedoms, the discrete degrees of freedom by which the atoms are described are eventually discrete, and we would use single photons to represent the optical fields. And the converse situation occurs in these schemes by the Polzig group in Denmark. These are actually schemes fully described by continuous variables, even though physically they are in a way similar, because we would also have a cloud of atoms, and light fields would interact with these atoms in free space. Nonetheless, the atoms would be described in this case by collective spin variables, which in a way, to some degree in this approximation, are then similar to these XP phase space variables that I showed you before. And the light field would be described by the so-called Stokes operators, which are also just continuous variables. So this is a scheme fully described in terms of continuous quantum variables, and the other one is a discrete variable scheme. And now I would like to describe a scheme to you. This is this hybrid quantum communication or hybrid quantum repeater scheme, where we use a continuous light field, or a continuous, I shouldn't say light field, an optical mode described by a continuous observable and an atomic spin system. So how does this work? Here's this quantum repeater. There are a few people who were involved in this work, and here is again the setting. So a qubit corresponding to a two-level system would interact with an optical pulse, an optical mode, which is the quantum bus in this case, and that would be described by a continuous phase variable. And then this pulse would travel through a channel and would interact with a second qubit, so again with a two-level system. And then we would eventually measure this optical mode. We would measure this continuous phase variable in order to conditionally prepare two-qubit entangled states. So the interaction that can be used for this is this controlled rotation here. So you can see that depending on the state of the qubit, that's the sigma z Pauli operator describing the qubit, or the qubit, depending on the eigenstate of the qubit, the quantum bus, the optical mode, acquires a phase shift, a phase rotation, and the sign of this rotation depends on the state of the qubit. And this this idealized unitary gate, this idealized interaction, is actually well known in quantum optics. It corresponds to the James-Cummings interaction in a certain regime, and the regime here is the regime of large detuning. So in this regime of large detuning, the James-Cummings interaction Hamiltonian would lead to a unitary transformation that corresponds to this kind of controlled rotation. Large detuning means the frequency that corresponds to the energy of this two-level system, the qubit here, is largely detuned from the center frequency if describing the optical mode. So it's largely off-resonant. Okay, here is a little animation. So in our protocol, a coherent state would interact with a qubit starting in a superposition state. So you see you obtain a kind of entangled state between the qubit and the optical mode. Then it would travel to the other side, to the other qubit, would interact with a second qubit. And in phase space, the two circles that got separated after the first interaction would now come together here again in the middle for the 0 and 1, or the 1 and 0 components. That is because we switched the sign of the theta here for the second interaction. For that reason, they would meet again here in the middle. However, the 1, 1 components and the 0, 0 components for the two qubits, they would lead to further rotations in phase space. So these two circles would then again be separated. OK, so this is then the scenario after this second interaction. Now, if we were able to measure these optical states and to discriminate between these optical states such that we can kind of rule out the upper and the lower components here, then we would conditionally prepare a two-qubit, in this case, a maximally two-qubit entangled state. However, you can see that there, along the p-axis, for instance, there are these overlaps, these finite overlaps, which would lead to errors in this scheme if we used homodyne detection. We could avoid these errors by making the d distances between these peaks sufficiently large. D is roughly the product of the coherent state amplitude times the angle of these controlled rotations. These angles are typically very small, so it's very hard to achieve large phase shifts experimentally. So assuming that this is of the order of 10 to the minus 2 or minus 3, it would mean that we have an alpha of the order of 10 to the 2, 10 to the 3, which means we have photon numbers in the pulses of the order of 10 to the 4, 10 to the 6. Yeah? So we could attempt to make D larger and larger and larger to avoid these overlap errors. But then the problem is that for larger alpha values, the effect of losses in the channel is more severe. Because in the realistic scenario, of course, the pulse would travel along this channel and there would be losses. So some photons would leak into the environment and they would leak which path information about the qubit into the environment. So only in the ideal scheme we can make D arbitrarily large and then completely avoid these measurement errors. But in the realistic scheme, there is a clear trade-off between our capability of discriminating these circles in phase space, here termed the distinguishability, and the effect of the decoherence coming from the losses in the channel. So typically, a D of the order of 1 achieves a good performance where this trade-off is optimal. And here's again the example I gave you before. That would mean we could, for instance, use these values. And that would, as you can see here, achieve at best a fidelity, an initial fidelity of these entangled qubit states of the order of 0.8. And this 0.8 can be only achieved provided we make the post-selection window for our homodyne detection, because we would only accept certain values by measuring along the p-axis, only certain values we would accept. And if we make this window sufficiently small, then the fidelity would go up, but it would not actually exceed a certain bound. And this is a kind of, in principle, restriction of this homodyne-based scheme. for a certain distance, of course, if we make the distance smaller, this is for 10 kilometers, the fidelity, this maximum fidelity would go up. If we make the distance even larger, then this fidelity goes down, which means we would not be able to distribute really high initial fidelities. And in this sense, the scheme is very different from these other repeater schemes. For instance, this one Lukin-Sirac-Fuller scheme, which is single photon based. In these schemes, the initial fidelities are typically very high, so they are close to unity. However, the success probabilities are pretty low, maybe into the -2, -3, or even smaller. So here it's more or less the converse situation. We can achieve reasonably good success probabilities here of the order of 30%, 40%. And at the same time, the fidelities would be not so high, modest, but we could still use these pairs for entanglement purification. However, one might also consider a scheme where we completely avoid these measurement errors, because these measurement errors are intrinsic to this protocol that is based on homodyne detection. If we think of a different measurement which completely avoids these errors, and such a measurement is given by so-called unambiguous state discrimination. So here we have these circles in phase space. These are non-orthogonal states. And we want to discriminate these non-orthogonal states unambiguously. So we don't want to make any errors. That means sometimes we will obtain inconclusive results, which means the efficiency of our scheme will go down. However, we will no longer make errors, which means the fidelity of our overall performance here of those two qubit entangled states that I would distribute would no longer be affected by an inefficient measurement in this case, in the ideal scenario. So here, I wrote down again these states that we have. So eventually, in this scenario, we end up having just a mixture of two states. And these two states are written down here. So the F, the fidelity here, that's not yet the fidelity, that's not yet the final fidelity of my qubit, two qubit entangled states. But this is a parameter that describes the mixedness of this mixture here. And this F becomes very, very large. So it goes close to one. The state becomes close to a pure state if we use very, very small alpha. However, if we use small alpha, we would no longer be able to discriminate these states in phase space by using USD. Of course, we could still discriminate to some extent, but the probability for achieving that would go down. So you see, this is what I said, the efficiency goes down. And there's again this kind of trade-off. Choosing alpha small means the efficiency in discriminating these differently rotated coherent states in phase space, this efficiency, the success probability would go down. And conversely, if we choose alpha very, very large, these states again become approximately orthogonal. So the USD, the unambiguous state discrimination, would have a success probability close to one. However, in this case, this F would approach 1/2. So we would end up having an equal mixture of these two states. So it would be highly mixed, the output state. Now, how can we discriminate these states in phase space using unambiguous state discrimination, so not doing homodyne detection? It is well known how to discriminate two coherent states of this form, plus minus alpha, unambiguously. This can be done by just using a beam splitter. So look at this example. I don't know if you are familiar with this example, but it's a really nice example because it achieves the quantum mechanical optimum. So there is an optimum, and a maximal bound, an upper bound for the success probability for unambiguously discriminating these two coherent states. And doing this optically by using a beam splitter and an Ancilla state, which is exactly this alpha state here, plus alpha. Look at the output modes, then here, if we obtain a click at this output, we could unambiguously identify the plus state at the input, because if it had been the minus state, there would have been the vacuum here, and that could not trigger a click here. And similarly here on this side, at this output mode, if there is a click down here, it unambiguously identifies the minus state, because otherwise there should be a vacuum. However, this state is, well, unambiguous state discrimination for non-orthogonal signal states, which means there must be an inconclusive result. And this inconclusive result is, of course, a vacuum, because this coherent state also has a vacuum component and this one. So if we have a vacuum at the two outputs, then we would not know which was the input state, plus or minus. And then one can calculate the weight and the probability of these inconclusive patterns. And this is the probability that is this factor squared. And that would just correspond to the overlap of these coherent states. So this is an optimal, quantum mechanically optimal, unambiguous state discrimination scheme realized by just using a beam splitter and photon counting, ideal photon counting, of course. Now, one could use a similar scheme for this repeater. But in the repeater, you remember, we have not just two coherent states. We have actually three coherent states in phase space. And so for discriminating these unambiguously, one may also use beam splitters, phase space displacements, and photon counting. And this is what we did, however, not in an optimal way, because the optimal scheme would be somewhere down here. So here's the, again, the, this is now the output fidelity of my entangled two qubit states after this unambiguous state discrimination measurement. And note that the regimes below the curves are inaccessible quantum mechanically. So not even in an ideal scheme, we were able to reach this area. This regime here, we would always be above this line. And in our schemes, in our protocol, we are even worse. We achieve some failure probability versus fidelity curves here. And here, even an odd refers to the two qubit subspaces onto which I project. So either an even or an odd Bell state. And so you see that we have at most a success probability of 50% in this scheme. Nonetheless, the scheme enables us, and this is different from the homodyne-based scheme, it enables us to achieve unit fidelity here for 10 kilometers. Recall that for the homodyne-based scheme, there was this upper bound on the initial fidelities. For 10 kilometers, it was 0.8. Now here, we no longer have this constraint. We are no longer restricted to modest initial fidelities. The fidelity can go arbitrarily close to unity. However, at the expense of a failure probability, which also goes up and approaches 1. But nonetheless, you can now even increase the distance. You can go to 50 kilometers, 100 kilometers, and you would still be able to obtain initial fidelities close to 1 at the expense of a success probability that goes down. So this is conceptually different from this homodyne-based scheme. OK, and then finally, I'd like to describe the subsequent steps in this quantum repeater. Now I'm wondering how much time, Steve?
There's still enough. Few questions afterwards. OK. Then, so obviously, in a quantum repeater, it's not only about distributing this initial entanglement. It's also about doing purification and swapping. So for this, we may use these local C0 gates and classical communication. Similarly, for the swapping, we would have to perform Bell measurements here in order to extend the distance. So now remember, we have in the homodyne-based scheme, the fidelities of these pairs are not so high. For 10 kilometers, they would be below 0.8. So we would actually have to do quite a lot of purification before we could do the first swapping. Otherwise, we would lose a lot of fidelity if we started straight away with the swapping. OK, but anyway, how can we do how can we implement these elements? By using the same resources that I described to you before, the same resources as for the initial entanglement distribution, which are these controlled rotations and these displacements here.
previously I didn't use these displacements. These are uncontrolled displacements. But if I add these uncontrolled displacements together with these controlled rotations, I obtain a conditional or a controlled displacement. Yeah, so controlled rotations and uncontrolled displacements can be used to simulate a controlled displacement. A controlled displacement. So here's here you can see what is happening. So first we displace in an uncontrolled fashion. Then we have these controlled rotations. Then again uncontrolled and controlled rotations and back to the middle. And then the overall transformation would be a controlled displacement. Why would that be useful? Once we can do controlled displacements, then by looking at the sequence applied to two qubits, one and two, together with my optical mode, this quantum bus, we can achieve an entangling gate, in this case a controlled sine gate, by choosing these beta values correspondingly, and using the controlled so this is the controlled sine gate that we can use to have the C naught for the purification and the swapping. And here again is the figure that describes why this works. This is basically a kind of geometric phase that is acquired by the qubits through just evolving the whole system together with the bus mode in this way, using these controlled displacements. So for instance, look at the first qubit in the zero state. It would mean that this has eigenvalue plus one, so it's displaced in the minus direction, so this goes this way. However, if the first qubit is in a one state, it goes that way. And then you can go through all the cases, and you see that for these four different states, we will always go along a closed loop here, however, with different directions, in different directions, and that means we have different phases acquired here, and eventually one gets this control sine gate. So theoretically, well, I should conclude this here. Theoretically, this is nice because we would use exactly the same resources that we had used for the initial entanglement distribution. We would use the same resources for purification and swapping. However, the scheme still is to some extent impractical, because if we did this with cavity QED and implemented all these controlled rotations in a kind of James Cummings type fashion, it would mean that here we have to couple in and out of the cavity, because we have two qubits in two different cavities, so we have to couple in and out of the cavity, well, four times, and that leads to high inefficiencies. So it would be desirable to, for instance, put all the atoms in one cavity. That would be one option. Or even to think of a free space scenario where we don't use cavities at all. But in a free space scenario, it would be pretty hard to achieve sufficiently high theta, because we have to couple the light field with the atoms. And so there are still many open questions in this overall hybrid quantum repeater scheme. Now I wanted to tell you a little bit about Gaussian cluster states, but I think maybe, I can show you a few slides.
Yeah, go ahead, because we started a few minutes ago.
Okay. So in a way, this is also a kind of hybrid scheme. I guess you're all familiar with this, with these cluster computation models or measurement-based computation models. And for the case of continuous verbal cluster computation, this initial multi-party entangled state would be a Gaussian cluster state. So you could think of preparing that state by just using single mode squeeze states and some, well, in the canonical definition, you would use these QND gates, quantum non-devolution gates, but note that these are still quadratic interactions. So this is still a Gaussian entangling gate. So everything is still all Gaussian. And so this can be implemented with beam splitters and squeezers once again. Then this overall Gaussian state
can be prepared in a deterministic fashion. So this is different from the single photon based cluster states, which typically require some probabilistic heralded scheme to make these states. So that's the nice thing here. However, of course, we've got finitely squeezed input states. So in other words, we would not obtain a perfect Gaussian cluster state. We would only get an approximate version of such a cluster state. And then if we use these cluster states, then we may use both continuous homodyne measurements and discrete photon number measurements in order to achieve universality. So in this way, it also contains this kind of hybrid feature, because by only using continuous measurements, homodyne measurements, acting upon this cluster state, it would mean that we would never leave the Gaussian regime once again. So we, of course, we cannot achieve universality. So this work was in collaboration with a few people, including also Nick from here, Nick Medicucci. And we had one result on how to make these cluster states in a rather efficient way by shifting all the squeezers that would be still contained in all these entangling gates, by shifting all these squeezers offline to the initial input squeezers. So eventually you would only have to prepare single mode squeeze states, and you would send them through beam splitters. That would enable you to prepare this state. Another scheme would be this compact generation scheme. I was not involved in this one, so this was Nick with some other people.
And Steve.
And Steve, sorry. Nick, Steve, and Olivier Pfister.
Yeah,
that's always the problem with the second authors, which are just as important. And here the idea is basically to do everything in one go, in a single shot. So rather than using many, many single mode squeeze states and having this large interferometer, you would rather have one suitably arranged quadratic interaction, which directly generates the corresponding cluster state. And how would you have all these different modes? Well, these different modes would be in frequency space. So you would have a pump, which has a certain bandwidth. And within this bandwidth, you have all these frequency modes, which eventually get entangled in this cluster state. OK, and then using these cluster states, well, this is all well known to you what it means to do cluster computation. Well, here I've got a small review on quantum computation with continuous orbits. So you, instead of the Pauli operators, you have these Weyl-Heisenberg displacement operators. We would use a unitary operator which is diagonal in the position basis in this case. This is just convention. So for convenience, this is the position basis here. And then we have a Fourier transform switching between the position and the momentum basis. We need an entangling gate, for instance, this quantum non-demolition gate. That's the same that we can use to make these cluster states. And then we have this set of gates where these gates, the red ones here, are basically the Gaussian transformations in analogy to the qubit case, the so-called Clifford gates. And if we add a gate that goes beyond the quadratic regime, for instance, the cubic phase gate, we could achieve a universal set of gates. And well, here, in analogy to the qubit case, the Clifford group unitaries are defined such that they would transform a WH operator into a different WH operator, similar to the qubit case where a Pauli operator is transformed into a different Pauli operator. So that leads to nice commuting properties, and that can be used for the cluster computation. But let me remind you of these general results on quantum computing with continuous variables. Also probably known to you that all Gaussian Clifford computation can be efficiently simulated on a cluster computer. And well, a more constructive result here that a single mode non-Gaussian gate would be not only necessary, but also sufficient for universal quantum computing. And based on these results, we can now think how to use these cluster states. And I think you give me 5 more minutes. I think, sure.
Well, I can also, or just 2 minutes?
Yeah.
Then, okay. So then this is the simplest scenario where we have two nodes of the cluster, and we just write it down in a kind of circuit picture. Here we have this D operator, which is diagonal in the X spaces. And now, instead of having these squeezed nodes, we may think of a quantum state which becomes attached to the, well, to this little cluster here. And then the nice thing is here that the D commutes with a control Z gate. That's actually the reason why we can put it in front of the detector. We can absorb both the Fourier gate and the D gate into the detector, which means eventually we would measure a rotated pre-quadrature in order to teleport the state psi down here, and the desired gate that we want to implement would be here in front of the state psi here, up to some correction, which is again a displacement, which we can undo once we know the results. And now it depends on the order of this D operator, if it is a polynomial or if it contains an Hamiltonian, which is linear in X, quadratic, or cubic. Depends on this order how the D operator would commute through these correction displacement operators, which means that if we, for instance, implement a non-Gaussian gate by having a non-Gaussian measurement here, we would also have to include feed forward because the commuting properties are not as nice as for the Gaussian gates, because the Gaussian gates, remember, they correspond to these Clifford operations. They would nicely commute through these Weyl-Heisenberg operators. So I think at this point I conclude, and I hope it was not too much and not too many different things I included in this talk. But the aim was basically to give you an idea of this hybrid approach, basically using discrete and continuous variables at the same time, and to advertise this idea in a way that it might be possible to have some kind of efficient implementations by using this. Thank you very much.
Questions? So following up this last slide, normally with these teleportation circuits, you can only do certain non-Gaussian operations.
Mm-hmm.
So which ones do you get?
So how to achieve a non-Gaussian?
Well, not all non-Gaussians can be done this way because the correction operation can be very, very messy.
That is true. Yeah, that's right. That's not for the case of a non-Gaussian gate. This is not a practical.
Oh, model. I see. Okay.
This is really just an in principle.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question to the quantum repeater scheme,
mm-hmm.
particularly for the animation which you showed.
Yeah.
I mean, you were saying that there's this problem that if you do heterodyne detection, that you have only a bound on the success property.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't, and Jan said that you can get rid of this drawback with other measurement schemes,
mm-hmm.
but couldn't you also change somehow the input state, because you're always inputting a coherent state.
Yeah, that is of course true. Yeah. So, but the coherent state is the most readily available state, the most practical state. But you could think of, for instance, the squeeze state.
Yeah.
So if you send a squeeze state through the channel, then first of all, it would be more sensitive to photon loss. That's well known. On the other hand, at the end of the channel, at Bob's side or at this other repeater station. After the second interaction for this measurement in phase space, it might be beneficial to have squeezed states because you can possibly discriminate them better in phase space. And in fact, this is something we are working on now. And provided the distance is not too large, like you can completely forget about 20 kilometers, or 20 kilometers is not so large, but even 20 kilometers would no longer work. But 10 kilometers is still okay. So for 10 kilometers squeezing, can help indeed. That's right. Yeah.
So how do you compare the rate of creating entangled states between your scheme and scheme like DLCZ?
That's a good question. So of course, the first step it's easy. That's this initial entanglement distribution. in for this first step, we are much more efficient in this hybrid scheme, but at the expense of this lower fidelity. That means we need already 6-7 rounds of purification to actually start the swapping. Whereas in these other schemes, the DLCZ scheme, they could just start swapping straight away, which means you would actually have to calculate an overall efficiency, including these extra steps.
But if you just focus on the first step, that mm-hmm. you just want to distribute entanglement,
okay. yeah.
for DLCZ, we know that the rate is proportional to the loss in the system or transmissivity in the system. If you want to make a similar comparison to, so with DLCZ, you get ideally a very high fidelity entangled state with that rate. With your scheme, you get a low fidelity state mm-hmm. with a higher rate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you want to purify it to a high fidelity state, then you need more copies, so the rate will be reduced.
Exactly. Yeah.
So how does your scheme scale with loss in the system?
You mean
how does the rate of creating high fidelity entangled state scale with the loss in your system?
You mean without adding these extra steps, just by
just
saying
the first step.
Just the first step. So you have more copies. Well, but well, that would still depend on how many copies. So you need
maybe we should describe it this way, that you have your scheme has a heralding probability,
mm-hmm.
which to say I have an entangled state,
mm-hmm.
and you create some entangled state rho, which is not maximally entangled state.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the maximum of this P of rho times an entanglement measure of rho?
You mean an entangled measure of rho would in this case mean the entanglement between the qubit and the light field before?
No, the final, between the two qubits.
Okay. Well, I think this is contained in this. Let's see. No, I don't have the slide.
So basically, yeah. This is state. It's,
yeah.
This.
Well, I was thinking because I had a different graph here, different figure, where it would exactly contain these 6-7 rounds of purification in order to achieve a fidelity which is comparable to that what you obtain in the DC and DLCZ scheme. And then you can really compare these two schemes. And then it turns out that this is slightly better, but the difference is not so big. Yeah. So, but I cannot, I mean, the figures of merit you are thinking of now is really like, I don't know, the quantity you mentioned, the product of the P heralded, this one.
P times some entanglement measure of the state of the two members.
But I think entanglement measure would basically, I mean, the fidelity is not really an entanglement measure, but I think you have in mind something like the fidelity, the ratio of...
I have something like entanglement of distillation or entanglement of...
Yeah, because I think this doesn't apply so easily to this continuous Weber scenario. I think you have in mind also kind of QKD application maybe, where fidelity directly translates into efficiency. I mean, I think your figure of merit eventually is just efficiency, isn't it? It's there's no longer this kind of, two-dimensional combination between fidelity and success probability. I think you only want to have one figure of merit, which is the success probability.
Yes, but yeah. Success probability of creating maximally entangled states rather than an entangled state
okay.
with a fidelity F.
Okay. I think this, but this figure of merit is, wouldn't that actually mean that you have to, wouldn't it actually mean you have an application in mind eventually, such as QKD?
Or
I cannot see how, I don't know, I cannot see how to just look at one figure of merit here.
Well, you can look at different figures of merit, but that's one of them. You can still look at FP as well as that product of P mm-hmm. times some entanglement measure.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we talk about it later. I'm not sure if this is the thing what we calculated, because we always have the kind of F and P together.
Yeah.
Maybe it's something to think about. I don't know, maybe it's something we didn't actually look at. So maybe let's discuss later.
Okay, so let's thank Peter again.